Blog Talk Radio.
MLK birthday holiday to you and yours. My apologies for starting a little late. My laptop was a little slow, and so I'm broadcasting from my iPhone 5S. Big shout out to T-Mobile. So I'm broadcasting from my landline, but then also from my iPhone 5S. And so I have to shout out T-Mobile, but happy MLK holiday to you and yours. I will start off, because my shows are now 30, 45 minutes, and we've missed 8 minutes with me experiencing technical difficulties. I listen to Beyond My Control. All shows will start on time, on point from now on. And that was my goal, but Murphy's Law, my computer was acting crazy, so logged in to my iPhone 5S, no problem, and I'm in the studio and all of that, so celebrate Martin Luther King birthday holiday, here we go.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must fail to conduct our struggle on the highest plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people, for many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution. And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
I don't know about you, but I am holding back the tears. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. I have a dream. You have a dream. Martin Luther King's dream is still alive and well. What are you doing? What part are you playing in keeping Martin Luther King's dream alive and your own dream, your American dream, your worldwide dream? What? The dream? Because sometimes some of us might feel like, wait, is there still a dream? Is the American dream still attainable, let alone any dream? But we must believe the dream is alive and well. Oh, man, I'm holding the tears. Been a little girl born, been a woman, 45-year-old woman, but a little girl born here in the state of Mississippi, in the capital city of Jackson, Mississippi, where Mayor Evers was assassinated, and where many, many white and black and all races marched and fought. Like those of you that are familiar with my cousin Linda, she was a part of the civil rights movement marching right next to the little girl marching right with my family. And she shared the story many times when the news was broke that he had been assassinated. But the dream is still alive, and, you know, We got to keep pushing. Like my friend Neil Thacker in Chicago always say, listen, we have to keep pushing and keep dreaming and keep believing. Happy M.O.K. Jr. birthday holiday. I remember, I'm 45, so I remember in the 80s when Stevie Wonder and many others would fought so hard and tirelessly for this day to become a federal holiday, And it's just, you know, it's just amazing to see that it is just recognized worldwide. It is a federal holiday and has been forever. But I remember when, it's just amazing. I'm holding my tears. So that is just so, so powerful. So we have to keep believing. We have to keep dreaming. Martin King Jr.'s dream is alive and well. And also, we must not give up on our own dreams, on our American dream and our worldwide dreams. You know, the sky's the limit. So we must just continue on. The live stream will stop, but I'll continue on and talk a little bit about different news. I received an interesting email from No Labels, which I'm a member of, that consists of Republicans, Democrats, and independents, and everybody who care about how America spends its money. So after I play this song by Okiriki, who will be returning to us after 2 years to update us on what's going on, miracles, because as we dream, we must also believe in miracles, right?
I think I changed the world today in an extraordinary way. A million soldiers all around me look up at their fearless leader and they say, show us the way. I go to sleep amongst the clouds, resting my feet against the moon. I made this promise to an angel, I'm out conquering the stars, I'll be home soon. And sure enough, as the eagle flies, my faith is blind, I do believe in miracles, heaven knows I'm a
Okey Ricky miracles.
I do believe.
Straight out of Savannah, Georgia. We can't wait to talk with him again on air with you guys so you can listen and call in and chat and all that good stuff. I received this email from No Labels, which I'm a part of. You guys can tweet them, like the Facebook page, go to the website, sign up, and become a part of No Labels movement also. This is an email regarding an article published in the Daily Beast today. And it reads, and the author is Malcolm Jones, and it reads as, Martin Luther King's Nobel Peace speech is an often ignored masterpiece. When Martin Luther King accepted his Nobel Prize, he delivered a speech that has been unfairly ignored because his delivery was so muted. Read 50 years later, it is electrifying. Okay, so I'm reading it. Martin Luther King's gifts were manifest. He was an inspired leader, a galvanizing orator, and a brilliant polemicist and prose writer. I said that right. But more than anything, he knew how to rise to an occasion. On December 10, 1964, when he received the Nobel Peace Prize, he knew the world was watching. He knew that he was the public face of the American Civil Rights Movement and that everything he said would be weighed and judged, sometimes harshly. But in that position, almost any of us would tremble. But King just stepped up to the podium and delivered one of the finest speeches of his life. And his speech was, it went like this. Well, I'm not Martin Luther King, but I'll do my best. I accept the Nobel Prize for Peace at a moment when 22 million Negroes of the United States of America are engaged in a creative battle to end the long night of racial injustice. He began, I accept this award on behalf of a civil rights movement, which is moving with determination and a majestic scorn for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice. I am mindful that only yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama, our children crying out for brotherhood were answered with fire hoses, snarling dogs, and even death. I am mindful that only yesterday in Philadelphia, Mississippi, young people seeking to secure the right to vote were brutalized and murdered. And only yesterday, more than 40 houses of worship in the state of Mississippi alone were bombed or burnt because they offered a sanctuary to those who would not accept segregation. I am mindful that debilitating and grinding poverty afflicts my people and chains them to the lowest rungs of the economic ladder. King was already famous as an orator, having delivered his I Have a Dream, which we just heard, speech before hundreds of thousands of people a year earlier. Though hindsight has elevated that speech to a level of recognition that it did not receive in many new accounts of the 1963 March on Washington. The Washington Post story, for example, ignored it almost completely, mentioning only one line in next day's coverage. In the space of a few weeks and forever thereafter, King was known almost exclusively for the Dream speech. Speech, as good as it was also typical. As an American orator, King had no rivals in his lifetime. He delivered rousing speeches time again to horrible effect. And people came to expect it, which may explain why the Nobel speech, unfortunately, gets less attention. If you watch a tape of the proceedings, you'll be struck by the speaker's somber reserve. There are no verbal crescendos. There is very little emotion and no drama at all. The template of most of King's speeches was the sermon, but this is not a sermon. Quiet and reflective, it is more like a prayer. And then they show a picture of King displaying his 1954 Nobel Peace Prize medal in Oslo, Norway. Was he nervous? Surely he was, but he had faced tougher crowds than the Nobel audience. No, I think his muted delivery was deliberate. I think he wanted to draw people's attention away from himself and put it on the substance of his text. But as a result, the address is almost too quiet because it is not the rousing King we expect. We are disappointed. That's a shame because if you ignore the performance and simply read the text, you get a completely different impression. On the page, stress is one of the most moving things King ever wrote. Indeed, when you read it, you comprehend how almost inevitably his oratorical gifts eclipsed his skill as a writer, but a great writer he certainly was. In that paragraph quoted above, his prose is specific, 22 million. Concrete, fire hoses, smiling dolls, and rhetorically rhythmic. I'm mindful. In 175 well-chosen words, he sums up the trials and the grit and bravery of the civil rights movement. As open as go, it's hard to beat. Then he does something a little daring. He calls the whole procedure into question. In doing that, he gets your absolute attention. Therefore, I must ask, why is prizes awarded to a movement which has been lingered and committed to unrelenting struggle, to a movement which has not won the very peace and brotherhood, which is the essence of the Nobel Prize? Why, I mean, has he come all this way to reject the prize? Where is he going with this? Wherever it is, you're going with him. After contemplation, I conclude that this award, which I received on behalf of that movement, is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral question of our time. The need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the people of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace, and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. If this is to be achieved, man must evolve for all human conflict, a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. Here and elsewhere in this relatively brief speech, only 1,150 words, King deflects attention away from himself. This award which I received on behalf of that movement, the sincerity which he makes himself one among many, diffuses any possibility of false modesty. But lest we miss that point, he drives it home with some plain-spoken imagery. Just a few lines later, every time I take a flight, I'm always mindful of the many people who make a successful journey possible, the known pilots and the unknown ground crew. The little miracle of King's writing lies in the way he so easily blends homemade metaphor, the flight crew, biblical imagery, the lion and the lamb, and poetry. Near the very end, he references a line from Keats. His prose, like Lincoln's, is plain and straightforward, and yet subtle enough to allow him to range from a whisper to thunder in the space of a few lines. At one point, he echoes another Nobel Prize speech when he says, "I refuse to accept despair as the final response to the ambiguities of history. I refuse to accept the idea that the inchness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him. I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life, unable to influence unfolding events which surround him. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war, the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality." This is very close to the language of King's fellow Southerner, Will Faulkner. His 1950 Nobel speech includes the sentiment, "I decline to accept the end of man. It is easy enough to say that man is immortal simply because he will endure, that when the last ding-dong of doom has clanged and faded from the last worthless rock hanging tideless in the last red and dying evening, that even then there will still be one more sound, that of his puny, inexhaustible voice still talking. I refuse to accept this. I believe that man will not merely endure, he will prevail. He is immortal, not because he alone among creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because he has a soul, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance." It would not surprise me to find out that King knew Faulkner's speech, but part of me thinks it's just as likely that he did not. that it was simply inevitable that two Southern geniuses, one black and one white, both troubled by the centuries-old tragedy of their region and both terribly aware of the threat of nuclear annihilation, could manage to wind up nursing the same hope against hope that things could get better, must get better. There is very little that seems dated about King's speech. Even 50 years later, he does make one reference to King Lutuli, who, if you're like me, you won't recognize. Albert Lutuli was a president of the African National Congress who was jailed and persecuted by the apartheid government of South Africa. In 1960, he was the first African to receive the Peace Prize, and like King, he believed strongly in nonviolence. Otherwise, the speech seemed eerily contemporary. True, it is grounded in the realities of his fight against a sort of blanket segregation that no longer exists, but his hope for a better future and his expressed faith in God and the Church of God is unassailable. He practically dares you to be cynical or pessimistic because he has rejected those things, and if he can, then so can anyone in his audience. It is a perfect speech. Now, Quiet King never learned when to use that and when to use which. Otherwise, it is hard to fault. He somehow manages to balance faith, realism, optimism, the news of the day, and the fate of the human race. And he did it in prose a child could understand and a poet with envy. With the eyes of the world upon him, he met the moment and mastered it. And I thank you so much for your support and tuning in to Motivating Monday, a special day, Martin Luther King Jr. birthday holiday. Thank you so much, and God bless. You've been listening to the Culture Shock Entertainment Report. I am Beth, a.k.a. Be True. God bless. Thank you.